Welcome back to the Music and Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel. With me tonight is Shane Settner.
Yo. Oh!
Transition.
Got him.
We usually talk movies here at the Music and Movie Club, but this is the third in our series of four episodes about The Sopranos in advance of the release of The Many Saints of Newark, coming October 1st. This week, we are going, or for this episode, weeks are meaningless. Who knows when I put these episodes out. For this episode of The Sopranos Recaps, we're going to be discussing the experimental episodes of The Sopranos, the dream episodes of The Sopranos, when the show got weird and alienating for the casual fans that might populate, say, the HBO message boards. We're discussing the 11th episode of the 4th season, Calling All Cars, the 11th episode of the 5th season, The Test Dream, and the two coma episodes, the 2nd and 3rd episodes of the 6th season, Join the Club and Mayhem. First, with Calling All Cars, this episode is not very plot-heavy. Vic the Appraiser plays a big role.
Vic. Just a guy trying to
I just watched this a couple days ago. This shouldn't be so difficult to sum up.
Well, it's because, like, there really nothing happens and you have a long, long dream sequence. It's only 47 minutes, I think, this episode, right?
Yes, this is one of the more insubstantial episodes. New York and New Jersey are beefing about the HUD scam that Tony instigated earlier in the season. Bobby Bacala's wife died earlier in this season, and Janice is making her move in this episode. But surrounding that, and the reason we're discussing it in this quartet, is because it's the first instance in The Sopranos, aside from the Funhouse episode where Tony dreams about Big Pussy being a rat, that is nowhere near as abstract as the dreams that follow Calling All Cars. And starting with Calling All Cars, you get the look of the show changes. It's not really advancing the plot in any way. It's kind of just what is literally going on in Tony's head. And the form that that takes in this episode is a lot of abstract dream imagery, a lot of like dream tropes, dream metaphors, easy psychology 101 type stuff, like with butterflies and caterpillars and all that kind of stuff. The show returns to Tony in his father's car. He's always driving in the back, as his dad would have preferred him to when he was alive. Except this time we see that Karma's in the front and he's got his various girlfriends in the back. It's alienating. Yeah, I think alienating is the word.
I love it. It's
not bad by any means. It's a slight left turn. The show was always somewhat interested in this kind of stuff, and now they're really making their play for it in this episode.
I love it. I love it. I like, as someone who's a lucid dreamer, this is fantastic. It just nails. I know whoever has written this, and especially this one in particular, whoever's written these scenes with the dreams has 100% is got to be like a lucid dreamer or a very light sleeper who is able to remember everything, because it just every cut is so good and it's all chaotic and it's fantastic. And I could see how some people might strongly dislike this, but they're fools.
Are those people the Furio's going to team up with the Russian to take revenge on everybody?
Yes.
People? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
You don't think it's too writerly? Like, we talked about the show being writerly with the Hawthorne quote from the college episode, a man cannot wear two faces, et cetera, et cetera.
I don't think so. I mean, because this is how you process things at times. I think you can have some clarity from dreams. Maybe you don't agree with that, but I feel like whether or not you're, I guess the theory on dreams, current theory on dreams, is your brain is basically putting things in places and trying to process all of it. So when you wake up in the morning and have a conclusion, it would make sense. You have some clarity if it's sleep. So these do not bother me. I think the people who this bothers the most are probably eating Ivermectin right now.
I thought about putting the Funhouse episode, because that is the actual first time. The show had dreams in the first season. They were like very straightforward sex dreams with Dr. Melfi. And then Tony hallucinated that Italian woman at the end of the
second, at the end of the
first season. But with Funhouse, that's more dreamlike in the sense of these episodes. But I really wanted to include both coma episodes at the same time. Like with Funhouse, I'm trying to remember how that one went. I didn't rewatch it. You get a lot of peer stuff. You get Tony losing a hand of cards to Polly and then shooting him blank in the chest, like square in the chest. That's all just keying in on something that Tony has known for a long time, that Pussy is a rat. Whereas the ones here, you could say these are fillers.
I don't... You think this is
filler? In this episode specifically, I kind of think, yes, filler. Because the only plot metaphor...
Yeah.
There's good character stuff here, I think, especially in conjunction with the therapy sessions. But the one thread of plot you could pull from it is what Melfi says about Carm driving in the front and the girlfriend's in the back. Like, you want to come clean with Carmella. Tony doesn't really want that, though. Like, I feel like Melfi is just spitballing.
I guess that's
Tony
fair.
Doesn't feel it bad does, about cheating.
Yeah, it does just kind of end, and that's it. It's just a trip, right?
Yeah.
And we get these confused. Like, this... this one just ends on...
There's two instances. There's the one in the car... with the various characters showing up, Ralph in particular. And then there's the second dream that closes the episode.
That's right.
Where Tony becomes his stonemason grandfather, and he's speaking, like, broken English. And there's a country house and a mysterious woman on the stairs, and he wakes up in Florida. Miami, I assume.
Yeah, it's Miami, yeah.
And then that's the end of the episode, yeah.
Okay.
I mentioned the therapy sessions with Melfi in this episode. Probably the most notable thing that happens here is that Tony quits therapy. He'll be back... a few episodes later, but here and there, they talk about the dream analysis, and Tony acknowledges, and I think the show acknowledges as well, that, and it's a common trope amongst like social dynamics, that nobody wants to hear about someone else's dreams, and that is probably also true when you're paying like $300 an hour to talk with somebody. It's inherently boring and solipsistic and self-centered. Like, this stuff only happened to you, and I think people also know that no one remembers their dreams, really. It's so disjointed and existing on a non-rational level.
So, one, I actually have never seen the word solipsistic before.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Solipsistic is... It's a fancy word for self-centered.
Okay.
It's relating only to the self. A thing can't exist outside of the self.
Now, I will... I as someone who's interested in dreams... I like hearing other people's dreams.
Maybe I'm just really bad at describing mine and are therefore uninterested in anyone else.
Anyone else. Like, if you don't have a good grasp on your dreams, which is how your brain is, right?
Sure, I could probably describe like 3 or 4 times in my entire life when like just an emotion like carried through to my waking self.
You and Blair are the same.
It's not that I don't dream either. Like, I'll dream between snoozes. Like, I'll 15 more minutes on my phone and then... to sleep a little more. And I'll have
that
dream
really
in that
weird, that really weird. Like, you start to half sleep and you start to think really weird thoughts. I love living in that spot right there.
Yeah, it's not helping me with my sleep in any way.
So fun. It's so fun. I can crush like a cup of coffee and then hit that spot for like 30 chaotic minutes. It's amazing. I wake up semi-refreshed and I've had some weird, like, you know, it's like this episode. I'm in a car and all of a sudden I'm talking to multiple people and. It's great.
Yeah, we'll talk about that more with the test dream and the transitions between like scenes in the dream. Yeah. It's not really relevant in like the Colonel Carr so much. These are very much set environments. But back to Melfi, we get like another big flashing theme alert. Where Tony, in the previous episode, we've had a conversation with Svetlana that we discussed in the family, lowercase family episode, where she talks about Americans being the only country in the world, or people in the world, who expect happiness, whereas everyone else expects misery, especially Russians.
Yeah, right. Right.
As we see from Bronka, who seems like a recognizable person, or at least a recognizable stereotype of a person. Just no room for small talk. All business, if you don't have anything. And this is something I actually do really admire about my perception of Europeans, is they have no room for small talk. Like, it's, you have to say something meaningful or say nothing at all.
Yeah.
And if you fill that space with words, you reveal to be a moron.
Well, you know,
I have a lot of respect for that.
I learned at some point, very recent post-college, hanging out with some of the grad students, the international grad students,
mm-hmm.
at Evansville, I would fill in words by saying, really?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. And I found out
They don't like that.
They don't like it. They're like, why are you questioning my truth? Like, why are you questioning what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do that same thing. Or if you were to say, how are you, to say a French person, if you didn't really mean it, they would be deeply insulted.
Yeah.
But of course, Americans, when they say, how are you, do not mean it anymore. Or just, how you doing? It's just, it's thought-canceling
well, when type I ask, stuff. When I ask how you're doing, I mean it. I want you to know that.
All right, well,
that's nice. I mean it. I actually mean it. I just want you to know I love you.
Great, that's nice of you to say, Shane. Okay. I love you too. Great. Edit out.
Done. Anyways, don't you dare.
Big flashing theme alert. Tony coming to the realization after Svetlana says that she dumped him because he's high maintenance in spite of all this therapy that he's been paying for 4 years.
Yeah, what's Melfi doing? And for her, 4 years.
Yeah, 4 years. And the subtext of all that is that just the American pursuit of happiness is a curse that ensures that you will always be pursuing happiness. You'll never actually find it. And as far as Svetlana is concerned, that's fine. It doesn't matter. It's okay. But for Tony, and I think in Chase's mind, especially Americans of that particular class, upper middle class or upper middle class to upper class, that's very much the same thing. You're never going to fill the hole in yourself that made you try and accumulate so much stuff in the first place. And Tony Soprano very much is an accumulator.
This is going to date exactly when we're recording this. But the whole AOC Met Gala stuff going on right now makes me just like it just burned a hole right in my brain when you said that. And I saw someone tweeted out like a blue check mark too. Like, why is everyone attacking AOC for this? Everyone would cut off their big toe to go to the Met Gala. And I cannot think of anything worse to go to.
When I wrote a review for Ocean's 8 at MunichMovie.club, which is a heist movie set at the Met Gala, the subtext in that movie, the text in that movie was, this is an awesome place that everyone would like to go to.
Sounds miserable.
The subtext to me was, this is grotesque.
It is.
You're making me hate these characters by seeing them constantly insist on how much they enjoy being there. So no, I don't understand the Met Gala. I don't understand thing one about the Met Gala.
It's so vapid. Like, and people said,
I AOC, assume it's for charity. I guess
it is for the Met. You know,
okay,
to keep the Met open. Okay. Which I can't imagine is that expensive.
What? The Metropolitan Museum of Art? Is that
yes,
MoMA?
Yes.
All right.
To keep that open.
So people can see, like, horse sections. I mean, I shouldn't shit on abstract art.
You can shit on abstract
art. I guess it's okay.
It's fine. But, I mean, and then you get, like, what, 10, 15% of these things.
Christ. Right. That debut.
They're using the money from the Met Gala to buy art right from the same fucking rich assholes, probably.
Sure,
some of it. Yeah. I know a lot of it's donated, but it cannot. If the cost is $200,000 a person or whatever,
I'm sad 35? That I know now.
Oh yeah, me too. All right, it can't be that expensive to hold that place open. Anyway, fashion sucks.
I agree.
No one should give a shit about it.
Sure.
And everyone's like, AOC did this, and she brought acclaim to a person of color fashion designer. To which I say,
she should have been there then.
Fuck off to that
person. Put her in the dress.
I don't get it.
Write the words on her back.
Yes. It's all fake. Anyway, we're way off. Either way, it's all vapid. It's all fake. And that's exactly what we're talking about here, right? The pursuit of happiness. Tony has all these nice things, which when eventually when you get to the last season of this, you just see Tony's got everything he could possibly want. And he's miserable, right? And this is why this is a good show.
Yeah, like if you boiled everything down to like that nugget of The Sopranos, that is it. Like the show exists in a country that spent all of its history up till now satisfying its citizens' every need, except for giving them some kind of broader purpose beyond accumulation. I mean, it started in 1989 when things supposedly are going swimmingly for the country and for the world. Maybe, I don't know, I'd have to reconsider that statement. The show didn't take an abrupt right turn or left turn in the middle of its run. Like, it's always been about this stuff. It's always been about decay and collapse. Why does nobody feel satisfied? And, like, even a person who can satisfy and does his every physical need is still miserable.
I don't have such a negative view of America.
I do.
I know you do. So I think most people don't live like this. And unfortunately, there are far too many people who think they should live like this. Mm. This country is, I mean, I think we're honestly at the peak of humanity for as far as selfishness goes overall. But maybe we've taken a few steps back. Like, we're back.
More selfish than we've ever been?
No, we're the least selfish we've ever been in the history of the world. Period.
Okay.
I don't think that's a whole another long-ass conversation. And I'll get way better at it once this edible kicks in. Sure. About 35 minutes.
Yeah, we'll talk about Polly's nuts getting really, just clubbed really bad. And then Shane will be like, I got it about America. Yes. So Polly's nut pain reminded me of it.
I don't have that view of America so much as you do, but I do see this right here. It's just absolutely grotesque. And or I feel like Tony surprised. That's why I like this show. I don't think it's something you notice in the first rewatch, how dumb everyone is. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Just the, like, banal conversations they have, and, like, why this show is so fucking funny is by having these what you would consider super successful people mm-hmm. be such fucking utter morons.
Yeah, that's totally fair. And if you're David Chase, you would apply that rationale to every studio executive you ever sat down in a room with.
Yes.
Every doctor you ever had a checkup with. Every lawyer you ever had to have a conversation with. All these people are successful, and I have no respect for them. Because very, very few people come off looking anything but complicit and conflicted and useless in The Sopranos. David Chase hates people.
Yes.
Which is part of also inherently why I think the show is so great.
So let's.
It's great in the same way that, like, The Room is the great. It's great in its own way. It's like a very specific peek into a very specific man. It's probably good that most people aren't David Chase. It's really good that one person was David Chase.
Yes, yes, yes. So if we want to talk about the dumbest of the affluent, the dumbest sounding of the affluent. Little Carmine.
The world welcomed Little Carmine Lupertazzi.
He's so great. Episode. God damn, that guy's so good.
Louis the Whatevers.
The Whatevers.
Minister. I did indeed look up this anecdote. It's adjacent to something like the truth. And Google knew exactly what I was Googling as well. I could have typed in Louis the Whatevers Finance Minister and been linked to the same Reddit page about Louis XIV's whatever. It's not a bad anecdote for the scenario that he's describing. He just tells it so badly. And the show leaves in a little pause where Tony just would like him to keep talking or be more succinct with his anecdote. And that kind of makes the scene, just that dead air.
That's so good.
Where Little Carmine takes another puff off of his cigar and fills the air with that instead. In a way, great, we're being European here. We're not filling dead air with fumfers and weasel words. But still, it's awkward.
Little Carmine owns every scene he's in.
Little Carmine features heavily in... Well, not heavily. He features heavily in one episode that we're going to speak about in the immediate future. We'll get a lot of mileage out of that.
It's Mayhem, right?
Yes, Mayhem. Yes, that's... His subspecies makes an appearance in Mayhem. getting further away from the dream stuff, because Little Carmine himself is a dream. AJ and Bobby Jr., that dynamic, I don't know. I feel like a teenager and like a 10 or 11 year old, it's interesting that admiration up towards AJ, who might get no admiration from anybody.
Oh,
it's interesting that doesn't do anything for him. It does the opposite of what you would expect. Like, you can't even humor it.
I thought he was humoring it at dinner when he was top dog because he had him laughing. And then as soon as his girlfriend shows up, he's like, yeah, I don't give a shit about this. That was perfect. They nailed it.
Okay, I mean, that's
what is it? Isn't that what I think what most teenagers would do? Like, kids are such a
wild thing. The introduction of the girlfriend, sure, that is a wild card. But he spends a chunk of the season bullying Bobby Jr., and it does come to a head in this episode. That's kind of how insubstantial Colonel Cars is. It's the peak of the
arc AJ between Bobby.
AJ Bobby, the AJ Bobby Jr. rivalry. He's very cruel. We don't have an AJ is awesome segment this week because he in fact sucks.
Do you have any friends with older brothers who are cruel like that?
I don't think so.
My older.
We did make the younger cousins like fight in the basement at my grandma's house for holidays.
Nice.
They seemed into it. They were like 6 or 7. They seemed to be having fun.
Oh yeah, until they don't.
Yeah, until someone like takes a metal pogo stick to the eye.
Right. My older brother and his football buddy would just set me and my brother up against each other and enjoyed it. And they would torture us a little bit. It got to the point when my buddy actually brought over the first year they had orange Oreos. Mm. He's like, "Hey man, there are orange Oreos back in this back room."
I'm imagining the Wonder Years theme song playing.
Yeah,
just the first. The pack that you pull out of your paper grocery bag?
Yeah. Well, he's like, "They're in this back room." I'm like, "No." He's like, "You don't want Oreos?" He's baffled. And I was like, "No." He's like, "Why don't you want to go back there?" I'm like, "This is a trap." He's like, "It's not a trap." I'm like, "This is a trap. No way. I'm not doing it. I'm going to get locked in that room." And I still remember this day I was wrong. He actually had orange Oreos.
That's back nice. There.
But I didn't ever went back there because I knew it was a trap.
And he held they a tortured grudge. Us. He held a grudge for her after. You just couldn't, you know, accept a compliment.
Yeah.
Or accept a kindness.
Accept a gift. Accept kindness. He thought it was hilarious that, like, they tortured us so much.
The Sopranos is the funniest show on TV.
Yes, it is.
We mentioned Branka. We only got a couple of scenes with her and Uncle Junior. I feel like they would have had a really nice back and forth. The show's conception of Russian hard asses. So, I have a lot of appreciation for. And Vic the appraiser we mentioned earlier. I would like someone on Sopranos to define what appraising is. Because they when we first hear about Vic the appraiser, Big Carmine refers to him as Vic. Johnny Sack likes to call him Vic the appraiser, which he says several times, like he's just coined an awesome nickname. And then every time the New York goons and the New Jersey goons are on him to, you know, get back to working for them, it's like, get your appraising shit and do some appraising. It's just, how many times can we say appraising or appraise or appraiser in this episode? And it turns out it's a lot.
Yeah.
It's funny every time.
I have one of those little wheel.
Do you? What is that for? Measuring?
It's measuring, yeah. Okay. Measure right off the inches. It's pretty awesome.
Well.
Got it from my dad.
Vic the appraiser needs a new one.
Yes, he does.
I think Joey Peeps
probably. I got one for you, Vic. You look me up. I got two. My dad gave me two.
Vito doing some muscle work. Uh-huh. He's not really set up for that.
He's not.
He's more like a stand around and look intimidating at best.
I don't know if you recall a scene when he smacks Vic the appraiser.
He's got big old meat mitts.
Before he punches him, he takes a deep breath.
Yeah.
It's so good. Like, they just don't miss the small moments. They don't make a big deal out of those small moments, but they don't miss it. You just see Vito take
really,
this big
really
breath.
Warm up.
Yeah, I just like stuff you don't want. I don't think you notice this the first time because in the second, third time through this series, you're just looking for all this stupid, funny shit on the side.
Hmm. The only thing to really say about Bobby and Janice is that Bobby calls Janice Marge Helgenbrunger or something to that effect, which I interpret as Marge Gunderson from Fargo, which means that Bobby's seen Fargo, which has Steve Buscemi in it, who will show up as Tony's long-lost
cousin. I was wondering
where
you got that from.
Yeah.
It's all the notes. I rewatched this today. And,
there is an actress whose name is Marge Helgenberger or something, but she didn't show up until after this episode aired. So that's what I assume, is that Bobby has seen Fargo.
Okay.
Where Tony B gets fed into a wood chipper.
Okay.
So he got out of prison for a little bit to film the movie. I appreciate that.
He did a great job.
Yeah, he did. Nailed it. Great in both.
I want to do a little fashion alert.
Yes, please.
Do you recall Carmela's white and gold shirt that I believe was made from curtains?
I don't. I really don't.
Oh, my God.
I watched this episode the most recently of all these four, and I seem to remember it the least.
I feel like...
This is like a bottom 10 episode, I think, in total.
Which is wild, because I don't mind this episode at all.
Okay.
I wonder what it stacks up, I guess. But she's got this great white top that has like a half neck, like half like mock turtleneck almost top. I don't know how to explain
it. I mean, sure, that sounds familiar.
And it cuts across, so it kind of has this little Asian-y like inspiration. So it's like almost
not
like
unlike what she wore in Marco Polo, where it's got like the strips of fabric going across her chest.
Kind of, yeah. It goes like the it buttons across. It buttons across.
We're both buying tickets to the Met Gala next year.
Yes, obviously. We're fashion people. But it kind of goes across. It looks, it feels, it has a feel of, what's the high neck dress, Japanese dress?
Oh, I, no idea.
Oh, this is sad that we can't get this.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah,
you know, Maggie Chung, Chinese, wore a very nice Chinese one.
I could be wrong.
Many times, and In the Mood for Love, I could not tell you what that's called.
So it's kind of, it feels a little inspired by that, but it also looks like it's made out of curtains.
Okay, yeah.
Fantastic, Carm. I love you.
Our next episode is The Test Dream. This episode is Tony working out a season's worth of problems in his subconscious. It is both plot-driven and more abstract. It's dreams that Tony's been having his entire life. It's characters from his past we've never seen before or heard mentioned before, showing up to play, like, major roles in how he thinks of himself and how he thinks of, like, alternatives to where his life might have gone. What's the subconscious telling him? It's telling him to reconcile with Carm. It's telling him to kill Tony B, played by Steve Buscemi from Fargo.
Can't keep your whores in the house.
Yeah, horse and whores, it turns out, sounds very similar.
God damn it. The show is so good. This, I think, is the best I think I was been mashing these two together. Like, the first one, this one, maybe I obviously should be lower on the clown cars, but this episode is the best representation of a dream I think it's ever been put on screen.
Yeah.
Period.
I guess totally fair.
And I don't think it's close. This is just so well done.
Sure. Like, the knock on Inception was like, that's not how people dream.
Right.
And I think, yeah, this is very much how people dream in this episode.
100%. This is the chaos, the cuts, the changing of people. The tropes, they are what they are, but that is how people dream.
Yeah. People have, like, internal, like, if we found a human society where, like, everyone's teeth was pulled out when they were 8 and no one had teeth, there would be some equivalent of a tooth falling out dream. It wouldn't be the teeth falling out, obviously, but it would be something else. It would be their fingers falling off or something like that.
Yeah.
That very much just seems like a shared evolutionary psychological thing. Where just pieces of your body, maybe it's why I love body horror so much, just bodies falling apart as a result of some psychological issue. It's conserved. That's the word I was looking for. It's conserved amongst humans everywhere, no matter what your cultural experience is.
Yeah. When I found out other people had that dream, like where their teeth are like falling out, or like falling apart, it blew my mind. It's like, I didn't know. I had no idea.
Sure. And you wonder too, does everybody have that dream because someone put it in a movie? Who had the dream? Someone put it in a movie or a TV show, and it just made its way through the culture, and more people are, and people have that dream based off of that cultural influence as opposed to some kind of conserved psychological influence.
I don't know, it's a good question. I think you're an idiot for suggesting that.
I disagree. This
okay,
why,
well, I'm
this
sorry.
Why it's a good podcast.
Sorry, I called you an idiot. No, I don't think that's it at all. I think it's, for some reason, there's just something, there's got to be some sort of genetic carryover with brains. I don't know. I have no idea.
That's the knock on, like people started having similar alien abduction dreams.
Yes.
And it's because they entered the culture after a certain period of time. Before that, it would have been possession or demonic possession or whatever.
I can't picture the teeth thing. This is just so specific, and you can feel that dream.
I mean, maybe in like the 19th century, everybody's teeth would have been falling out all the time anyways. Sure. It would have been like a totally normal thing to happen to a person.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. I don't know. Our ancestors coming around the boat probably had scurvy and teeth falling out and shit.
That's true. But it would have been just like a totally normal thing to happen.
Yeah. But they were unprepared to go starving, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, right. Yeah, they were shooting revolver bullets made of chocolate, too. What I assume was chocolate. We mentioned the plot directives in these dreams. Like, what are like the psychological themes? Death. Like, if Tony is understanding, as he did with Big Pussy in Funhouse, that he needs to kill somebody, this like dream session is his subconscious telling him, this is final. This is a cruel thing to do. Fundamentally, no one's going to heaven. They're not going to a shiny, sparkly place where they're gonna have all their needs satisfied. They're just going to be lonely, at least as far as Tony is concerned. I mean, I know what happens to them. they decay on a woodpile, in Tony B's case. There's just nothing there. There's no happiness to be taken. There's no greater knowledge. It's just cold and lonely and empty. And that's what... And that this comes up repeatedly. This comes up with Carmine, who Tony wakes up in bed next to. This happens with Gloria.
Great, great fucking cut, by the way.
It's a really strong cut.
God damn.
And an old Tony Lip, just Tony Lip, who, of course, was the basis for Green Room. Green Room, not Green Room. Green Book.
Green Mile.
If only. Who would he have been in Green Mile?
Tony Lip?
Yeah.
He played the mouse.
Wow, really good. Really good on his part.
Yeah.
Really impressive.
Nailed it. You see how he's just juggling the little thread thing.
He's a brilliant actor, Tony Lip. We get it from Gloria as well.
I'm picturing with his nose just the little spool across the room.
He's like Tony Lip. He's in like a green CGI sock.
Yeah.
And they're gonna shrink him down into a mouse for the movie.
We need the mouse to have your facial expressions.
I thought that mouse in Green Mile looked familiar, and now I know why. It's because I can imagine this mouse stuffed with egg salad choking before he has a stroke. We get more dream tropes in this episode. We mentioned the teeth falling out. Just general unpreparedness. I mean, everybody's had that. I'm sure it's usually like school-related, missing a book. All of a sudden, it's finals time in some physics class that I didn't understand when it was real, and I took a semester full of physics anyways. Sure, Tony has those dreams as well, and just again, he's unprepared to kill his cousin. Like, his subconscious is increasingly telling me he's probably going to
have to. For his cousin to pull that when he's got so much going on? Is that something Tony says increasingly more and more? For this person to do this? Why I have so much shit going on.
Sure.
So much shit happening
to
me.
That's pretty standard Tony. Like, before the dream stuff, we get Tony complaining about this shit always happening to him, while
yes.
Tony B is very, very angrily throwing his kids' toys away. After his best friend from prison has been killed, and I think at that point Tony B knows that has happened. After this whole thing happens, there's just no one to call for Tony but Carm. She immediately recognizes his Coach Molinaro dream, where Coach Molinaro was Tony's baseball coach, who wanted Tony to be a coach on his own. In Tony's recollection, he was just lying to Coach Molinaro, who may or may not make an appearance in the Many Saints of Newark, to get him to lay off Tony. But Carm, who also existed in this period of Tony's life, disagrees. Like, maybe Tony could have, in fact, been a coach, and Tony, you know, he's a coach in his way, and they just make some cute little small talk with each other in a very like, I remember my favorite part of this episode as I was watching it, maybe still today, is that like early fade to black and the episode ending as they just chat with each other.
Eve Hawkins, she's amazing.
Yeah,
she's just amazing.
She's not angry that Tony called very early in the morning. She is immediately understanding that he had another Molinaro dream, and she's willing to talk about it with him, which is what she wanted from Whitecaps. Trust me as someone who has stuff to say.
Yeah.
So it's nice. It's not globally nice that they get back together, because it is just such an act of complicity on her part, but this is just evidence that it was probably always going to happen anyways.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
We mentioned the Met Gala. Adjacent to the Met Gala is just the whole atmosphere at a place like the Plaza Hotel in New York overlooking Central Park. Just this fantasy world of wealth and comfort that, thanks to the directing of this episode, still feels ominous and heavy and freighted. And there's just a lot of dread hiding behind this millionaire bride taking millionaire pictures for her millionaire wedding. We also see Tony within this bubble being bored out of his mind. He prank calls Charmaine.
Would you call it? You think it was a prank call?
Well, I don't know. What else would you call it? Like, if she says repeatedly, he's been repeatedly calling her. She picks up. He says nothing. That would be a prank call if the intention was just to fuck with somebody. He's trying to work the nerve up to ask her
Isn't
out.
Isn't it so wild?
It's so
Can you
pathetic.
Imagine what he's thinking in his head? It is pathetic.
It's just more Tony Soprano self-hatred. Like, why can't I ask this person out on a date? She would obviously say no.
This person knows who he is.
Yeah, I think he knows that it wouldn't go well. And I think in the first season, she like explicitly turned him down or laughed at the idea that they would ever get back together after having a little tiny fling in high school. He eats dinner alone. He watches the Plaza promo video. He hires an escort. It's not a compelling view of vast wealth that we see from Tony in this episode.
Yeah.
He's doing nothing different than he would if he was staying at a Days Inn.
He just
which probably don't exist in New York City, but I don't know.
He just,
some shitty hourly hotel in New York.
He's just completely lizard brain, or like he's just like a shark. His cast to constantly be in motion.
He doesn't even like turn on the TV to watch anything. Like
no.
ESPN or like the old TV shows that Tony likes. It's the Plaza promo video of all things. It's channel 2 on every hotel everywhere. One more thing before we get into our segments. As The Sopranos is being watched by more people, I'm noticing, on Twitter. And as younger people watch it, in like having marinated in like whatever the culture is talking about for the last 10 years, 15 years since The Sopranos has been on the air, I'm like reading a lot more stuff from like the children of critics who see Sopranos as what most shows of this era were about the whole time, which is like a masculinity deconstructor. A lot of the show is how men are supposed to act. And the big example of that in this episode is with Tony B, who's, you know, on his way out. But we see him with Angelo, like, be affectionate and honest and grateful. And he's saying exactly how he feels to Angelo, which is a big no-no in Sopranos world, but especially around emotional type stuff. And then once Angelo is killed, he reacts in the most masculine way possible by like taking revenge and failing to kill the guy he meant to kill in the first place. So yeah, it's more stuff to write about if I was writing like a AV Club review of this episode.
Yep, like I had something to say and I completely forgot, John. That will hit.
That's okay.
I had something. It was good too. I thought maybe not.
Yeah. We'll never know. Sopranos is funny. The transition from Charmaine, from Tony with Charmaine, having sex with Charmaine, to the horse, complete with Artie coaching about how Charmaine likes it when you rub her muzzle. I mean, that joke's not aiming high by any means, but that's fine.
It's great.
That's fine. The old Vin McKaysian from the first episode, or the first season, reemerging as married to Annette Bening. Just him singing the entire Lionel Richie song is one of those instances where something is initially funny and then becomes not funny and then becomes funny again by the end. So, yeah.
I love the reaction.
Tony's dreams are funny.
Everyone's slow reactions as it goes. It's and Annette Bening's face go just as it melts to nothingness.
Yeah, she's a
pretty
practice.
Fucking good.
A very good actress, Annette Bening, who can turn her emotions on and off while her face doesn't change in any way. We get some of Charmaine's assets. Two large ones are prominently displayed as she's grinding pepper for Tony. And perhaps the biggest one is that she's a licensed notary public, which is exactly the kind of woman that Tony needs. Someone who has someone who has pull in the bureaucratic world. That's what Tony needs. I mean, you could see how it would be helpful for him.
Sure, sure. It just like why? Who thinks to add that? Because the line perfectly fits with this whole world. But who thinks to add that?
It's a valuable skill. She did all the paperwork and everything. And Fashion Corner.
We don't get a lot. I think simply because we're in Tony's subconscious with Carmela, so he has her in.
I really like the way that Annabella Sciorra, who plays Gloria, is sitting in Melfi's chair.
That is a
very classy pose.
I love that whole.
We didn't do any episodes, and we're not going to, that have Gloria in them, which is a
shame. Yeah, unfortunate. As I say, just Carmela's in this nice black, like, kind of suit, skirt thing? Skirt suit? That's how we were, put those words. Very understated. And then she meets Annette Bening for dinner, and Annette Bening is in this nice white, very fancy.
That's a pantsuit.
Pantsuit, yeah.
Yeah, she's a Clinton acolyte.
Just the two, the posing, what we have going on there. That was nice, and I was going to comment on Charmaine's outfits.
We mentioned her aggressive cleavage. Aggressive. Yeah. Yeah. This episode and Join the Club both are surprisingly high in Sopranos rankings. They're not my favorite episodes, certainly, but they're a lot of people's favorite episodes. Which, I mean, from a critic's standpoint, it's just kind of a lot to write about. In both of these cases,
I feel like it's an easy trap to fall down. Let's psychoanalyze.
What does this mean? What does that mean? And again, from Calling All Cars, the show thinks all that is stupid. Dream analysis. Our next episode is Join the Club, the episode in the immediate aftermath of Tony being shot by a confused Uncle Junior who thinks he's shooting Big Little Pussy Malanga when he is in fact shooting Tony right in the guts.
The gun went off.
What is this man talking about? Angry Uncle Junior, solid.
So good.
If only he had a pie to shove in that lawyer's face. Join the Club is the second episode of the sixth season. It's split half and half between the real world, where Tony is lying on a bed with a giant open wound in his stomach, which I am shocked is a real thing. That seems like the opposite of a good idea. To have an open, gaping wound in someone's stomach that remains open for easy access. Whatever. Not a doctor. The coma reality of Tony, where he's undergoing like a case of mistaken identity. He's still Tony Soprano, but he's the version of Tony Soprano who took up selling patio furniture, as he often talks about. Now he sells precision optics to the Defense Department. And while on a conference, he loses his briefcase and swaps his briefcase for someone who looks strangely like him and is also a shyster like the real Tony Soprano, and other stuff happens. Join the Club. What'd you think, Shane?
I do enjoy both these episodes. I think all the weird episodes they do are great. I'm just... For this one, it is a bit jarring, but I think you get so much about Tony just being so wildly insecure and trying to figure out, but also just being... kind of no empathy, no ability to kind of really think through things other than what's the easiest thing in front of me.
Say more about that in this episode.
I think it's for between both of them, where he just takes over the persona. There has to be other ways to figure something out if you're on this sort of situation, but Tony's coma persona just takes the easiest way out. I'm just going to charge this to this guy. And that's it.
I think that was the right thing. I would have done the same thing, I think. If I was in that real scenario and I had someone else's idea, I would give it a shot.
I think.
If they say no, and then I leave. Try a different hotel. Like, what else would I do? I don't know what else I would do.
I guess, yeah. Yeah. I guess back then you didn't have access to everything. So.
I think the difference there is that Dream Tony is bad at it. He's bad at pretending to be Kevin Finnerty. He's extremely nervous. He gets slapped by some monks that Kevin Finnerty screwed over and reacts as if he had been shot again. Like, he stumbles backwards and in complete shock. He screams at whoever is around. Not like Tony Soprano screams, but like regular guy screams, like Beta Cuck Tony scream. Like, those guys slapped me. Someone call the cops. That vision of Tony within Tony is... just not a tough man. He can't cheat on his wife, even though he makes a pathetic attempt to. He's a totally normal person who like is a functioning member of society, and his life is not horrible. He still is unsatisfied and unhappy because it's The Sopranos, and because in this world everybody in the entire country is unsatisfied and unhappy, and those that aren't make Tony want to smash their face in the hamburger, and we never see them in the show anyway, so they may as well not exist. But he can function in the world. Like, coma Tony just doesn't have Tony's lack of conscience that spices real Tony's life up, but at the same time, he doesn't get to live unblemished life, I guess I would say. It's interesting that Tony would imagine himself to be this guy, when the real Tony is more Kevin Finnerty than Dream Tony, selling precision optics to the Defense Department.
Real Tony had a leg up, right? So this is where Tony would be. I feel like this is where Tony would be on neutral if he didn't grow up the son of a mobster.
I think everything about Coma Tony is the same, except for this pivotal like alternate universe choice where he just got out of New Jersey. I think his parents are still his parents. I think his wife is not Carmela, certainly. I think he lives in New Jersey. Coma Tony. I can't remember exactly. He definitely mentions it, or his wife, whoever his wife is, mentions it. But I do think everything else is the exact same. It's hard to tell exactly because they don't explicitly mention like Livia or Johnny Boy or Tony's like vague past as being connected by birth, like being born into a mafia family. But I very much get that sense. I get the sense that like sometime in his 20s, he put away his like hard Italian accent or Italian-American accent for something much softer and much more accommodating, all the better to sell patio furniture to whoever. And then he gets to Costa Mesa and runs into kind of real Tony, like actual Tony in Kevin Finnerty. And I'm talking myself into it. And becomes a person who Tony would fuck over and not think twice about. Nothing comes of it. Tony, over the course of the rest of the sixth season, Tony is going to attempt to have a live and let live attitude, and then he gives it up eventually. Because of course he does. Because right. That's the show.
Well, got very inconvenient.
Yeah. So I think a tiny, tiny part of Tony, after he wakes up at the end of Mayhem, the following episode, remembers what it was like to be screwed over by someone like himself, and to be confused and flustered and fading, because he also gets diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And some of that pushes real Tony, once he wakes up, to try and improve himself. And of course he fails.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, if you consider, you know, suffocating your nephew and stuff, failing.
He failed long before that. More somewhat on the nose symbolism and join the club. It doesn't seem like this kind of stuff bothers you at all. We talked about Christopher with like his whole life trajectory being altered by a bum in a shitty car with a lot of kids. We talked about that. Kind of didn't work for me on a second take. It's exactly right for him, sure. The show is as smart as its characters are in some ways. But the symbolism here in Join the Club is like you get a lot of wildfires on TV.
Yeah.
The person's name could be anything. But it's Kevin Finnerty, as in infinity. A guy at the bar makes that joke. You see, like, these Christian commercials, like, oh, is Tony going to go to hell? He's going to go to heaven?
Yeah, the Christian commercials, I think, in
particular. It's just a little much. Egregious. Everybody stops and looks. They could have tightened it up a little bit, but it's like a half an hour of, like, Coma Tony. And those are small little things that I felt needed to be mentioned, but, you know, here and there.
Yeah, I enjoy the whole weird, just the weirdness of it. I think it would be wild to be a Sopranos fan and not enjoy this.
Yeah, it's just like, what show have you been watching the whole time?
Yes.
To think, like, this is so totally out of left field. And this is, make no mistake, this is not weirder than The Test Dream or Funhouse or Calling All Cars to some extent. Coma Tony is pretty straightforward in what happens to him. Like, he's reacting and experiencing this as an actual person. And the ending, I love the ending of this episode. Might be the best thing about it. With the Moby song playing and like and Coma Tony deciding not to call his wife and tell him about the Alzheimer's diagnosis. Where he's just like falling into the same traps that real Tony was falling into. He's not being honest with people. He's keeping secrets, etc., etc. Really great stuff. In the real world, briefly, We see a lot of the mobsters fighting amongst themselves over who was helping out the family the most. I think Chris is pretty clearly the winner. I think he knows how to deal with Carmella and Meadow in the correct way. He doesn't have anything to say. He doesn't say anything. He's just around. He's there to, like, hug and be a shoulder to cry on. Good for Chris. Great on Chris. And he gets a stereo for Tony before Paulie can come up with it. Good job, Chris. You're doing very well in this episode. He, in a conversation with the FBI agents, gives one of the better in a long list of Sopranos gesticulations. It's like a slow motion elbow bend that they do all the time. But when it's really slow and deliberate, it puts several exclamation points on whatever he's saying to them.
I feel like I need to go back and watch this.
It's great. It's a great, we'll call it an elbow bend.
Does it just kind of go up slow?
He's talking about terrorism and how seriously they take terrorism.
Okay.
You are high.
I'm very high, but I'm very interested in what you're talking about right now.
The FBI agents have been transferred from organized crime to terrorism. And they say to Chris, if you ever hear anything, let us know. And Chris is like, I take that terrorism shit very seriously. And Tony, hand out, elbow up, forget about it.
I'm going to go back and rewatch the episode just for that. I love the gesticulation.
This is an audio medium and I'm doing a lot of hand signals. Whatever.
It is, for the audience at home, it was like a less racist version of the tomahawk chop for the Braves.
It's essentially in reverse. Tomahawk. That's fine. I have no issue with that.
All right.
Our final episode is Mayhem. This is really light on the dream stuff, but I had to include it just for the conclusion of the coma stuff. We'll get that stuff out of the way first. My interpretation of all this is, like, this is Coma Tony preparing to die. He speaks with the monks who have really nothing to offer him. He starts telling people in the coma world that he's sick and he's fading away. And at the moment of truth, where you really get the impression that if he walks in this giant house that he's been invited to in the coma world, that's it, that he's dead. If he gives his briefcase to Coma Tony B, who Tony doesn't recognize, then that's it. He'll die. Everything about the coma world, that house, the people in it, it looks nice. It's lit nice. It's lit warmly. He's really only pulled back by Meadow's voice. And he goes from this heaven metaphor to a very dazed and miserable looking state in the hospital, where you get that great line from exhausted James Gandolfini where he's like, I'm dead, right? And just the way that he whispers it to Carmella. I feel like you can smell Tony just like coming off of the screen in that moment. Like, I'm dead, right? Probably should have died. Probably would have been better for everybody. It's almost like a selfish act that he came back. He should have walked in the house. He should have given his briefcase up. I mean, if you think about this point in the series, if he had died, obviously Christopher is still alive. Probably his children and his wife don't see him killed in front of him.
Yeah, those,
in front of, like, them, which I do think is what happened.
There's a lot of people alive.
yeah, there's more people alive. The New Jersey family pretty obviously would have gone to war with each other, but that's their problem. It's just kind of better for everybody involved. Maybe AJ does, in fact, join the army like he wanted to. That's the coma stuff is maybe a quarter, probably less of this episode. The rest is... A big chunk of the rest of this is like Stevie Van Zandt, who plays Syl, his Lilyhammer audition. Like, that's the Netflix show that he picked up after The Sopranos ended. I never saw a second of that. I don't know if you did.
I didn't watch it either.
Neither did I.
I just
it's Syl in, I want to say, Norway.
I didn't want it to ruin this.
It ran for 3 seasons. Maybe it's not. I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
But
this is as big a showcase as Syl ever gets. And I think he's really good. Like, acting is certainly not Stevie Van Zandt's first calling. Like, he's, you know, a guitarist in Bruce Springsteen's band. It's a really interesting look into Syl's life. His house is modest compared to Tony's. His ambitions are modest compared to Tony's. He has a really nice moment with Tony at his bedside, especially compared to Paulie, who does not have a nice moment at Tony's bedside. We'll talk about that later. But he is also an ineffective leader, and the show goes out of its way to demonstrate why he's so bad. Like, in the words of Breaking Bad, there's just a lot of half measures with Syl. You got to make a decision.
He cares too much.
I think, I don't know. I get it. I get not wanting to tell Bobby or Vito this neighborhood is yours now, because there's no right answer. It's all bad.
He just cares about disappointing, which is why he's great number two.
Yeah, he's exactly where he's supposed to be. And he ends the episode after having an asthma attack, carted off to the hospital, whatever. This episode brings us back to Christopher's Hollywood aspirations. We get to see JT, the writer from the fifth season, who had a gambling problem that Chris totally took advantage of, much like Tony did, with David Scatino. We get to see him in a Writers Guild meeting. A lady in a top hat is just shocked and stunned, which I think is, that's our fashion corner for this episode, is a writer lady in a top hat. How dare you?
Very typical.
How dare you? Chris's movie pitch is great. It's science, or maybe it's supernatural. that's going to factor big into the following season. This is where it starts. This is really like the last little chunk. This is of Carm questioning her lifestyle. We talked about in long-term parking the way that she and Tony came to an agreement. It cost her $450,000 or whatever to put this concern away. And she got it and she put it away. But the only thing that's left for her is her children. And even that doesn't really come up in the rest of the series. I mean, we leave with Meadow probably becoming a mob lawyer and AJ becoming Little Carmine, kind of.
Somehow less talented?
Somehow. So that's a great scene. That's a great moment for Edie Falco. I love it when she is in a therapist's office. She's not the most interesting person in the world by any means, but we get like three or four of those over the course of the series, and each one is great, as is this one. But yeah, she's just totally checked out. She would like her husband back. She would like to go back to that sushi restaurant. Portia Cayenne needs an upgrade. Whatever. She wants to get back to her life. We get a lot of Vito. We're going to get more of Vito in the rest of the season. He's going to find himself in like a really awkward position. I think the show is going to ask a lot of the audience to feel bad for him. And this episode makes that very difficult because, good God, he sucks. He's undermining everybody. He's a climber. And even Phil Leotardo thinks he's acting inappropriately.
That says a lot because Phil Leotardo's
kind of a piece of shit. Just him chomping away on those baby carrots, I think, is a nice touch. He's lost all this weight, but as far as the show is concerned, like the thing that made him gain all the weight hasn't gone anywhere. The Sopranos is the funniest show on television. Really, Paulie at his obnoxious best. He murdered an old woman with a pillow. Not as obnoxious as he is in this episode. He almost kills Tony with his yammering about his groin injury and the way his biceps have become as wrinkly as an old lady's cunt. Him coming into the room, being warned repeatedly by Meadow to keep up a positive attitude. Then for a period of time, 30 seconds to a minute, and then the second he walks into the room, oof my don, he looks terrible. What? That is a classic joke that someone probably graffito tagged on a Roman wall 2,000 years ago. That's how long that joke has been funny. It continues to be funny today. That's just like classic vaudeville. Couldn't have wrote it better than it is. Don't need to think about it harder than you do. Perfect, perfect joke. We also see him complaining about paying Carmella Tony's cut, which Tony would be entitled to as the boss of the family that his captains, you know, generated. Tony's in a coma, might die. They don't want to pay it to Carmella. We cut to him having this realization, and from the realization to him clipping coupons, which is a very, really a nice window into how Paulie lives his life. He spends all of his money on white shoes and whatever he can save from coupons. He's a high-up mobster in this world. I think it's exactly right. And the last thing to say about Mayhem is we get a glimpse into the Sopranos Movie Club, which, you know, we obviously have a soft spot for here at the Media Movie Club. where Benny is in the background pitching plot points. Syl having pretty smart stuff to say about the history of horror movies, like Michael Myers was this and Jason was that. I feel like he's seen all those movies, and just the idea of Syl watching Nightmare on Elm Street, I think, is delightful. And then Chris just getting frustrated
the and knives frustrated. In the sky. is that what it would be? Knives? Hand knives? I don't know. I'll
work something on. Like that. Syl knows what he's talking about. He's up on them. He's seen them all. He's seen all the sequels to Friday the 13th. JT's frustration at all this, combined with his fear, like, he understands the crowd that he's in front of, and they're going to quibble with him about the right way to dispose of a body. Probably a little intimidating for poor JT. And yeah, as I mentioned, this is like Christopher's growing frustration that people are critiquing his plan. Ghostbusters, another fucking moneymaker. Really strong stuff. More conversations about movies with the crew of The Sopranos, please. I would appreciate that. In. Yeah. If you would like more conversation about movies from us, which after listening to this episode, I don't know why you wouldn't.
At least one of us.
typically here, of course, in the Munich Movie Club, we do discuss movies. We discuss movies three at a time over the course of the month. Reviews posted at MunichMovie.club. Our last three movies were spoofs. We discussed Clue, and They Came Together, and Galaxy Quest. And our next three movies were just kind of back to picking randomly. We selected Coda, a movie on Apple Plus, and News of the World, a Tom Hanks movie from the end of 2020, and the movie that instigated this whole Sopranos miniseries, The Many Saints of Newark,
yes. Which
comes out October 1st. Very excited for that. The reviews seem to be good as they come in. We'll be discussing those movies and many more on our website in the next few weeks. Like us on Facebook at Munich Movie Club. Follow us on Twitter at Munich Movie Club, and on Instagram at Munich Movie Club. Our final episode of the Sopranos miniseries is going to be about the bad Sopranos episodes. So we've got Hit is a Hit. We've got Christopher. Speaking of Vito, we've got Johnny Cakes, which is Vito in New Hampshire or Vermont. I get those states confused. And we've got Chasing It, which is Tony Goes Off the Deep End with his gambling problems. People don't like that episode. I think we will find that Shane and I feel differently.
Sure.
That's a good episode as far as I'm concerned, but whatever. Maybe we'll change our minds. That's it. Thank you for joining me tonight, Shane.
Sorry, John.
Nope.
Thanks, John.
Have a good night.
Oh, man, that hit way too sharp, man.
Yeah, that's fine. That'll happen.
Holy shit.